and welcome to another edition of the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On today's show, we'll be talking about why 1997 was a defining year here in the UK.
Plus, we'll be talking to Swedish electro band Little Dragon.
And we'll be talking to Ben Eastham from literary publication The White Review on their latest book, celebrating the magazine's first 20 issues.
All that, plus Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be dishing out the news look ahead, and we'll play some great music too. That's all coming up on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. There we have it, Tom. We're in the hot seat once again. It's good, isn't it? How's your Sunday shaping up?
House tricks.
What happens after this?
Not bad. I never look that far ahead.
No, you don't.
I don't like to tempt provenance.
No. Okay. So if you had like a sort of a big sort of family Sunday lunch plan, you wouldn't want to bring other people into your
exactly.
sort of into your karmic orbit. Let's get the show on the road, and that means bringing out Henry Rhys Sheridan for the news look ahead.
Henry, oh Henry, love the way you jump.
Hi, Henry.
Hi, Rob. How's it going?
Very well, thank you so far. We're 2 minutes in. It's been great.
And hi to me as well.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
So, just checking.
You all right?
Yeah, very good.
Don't bring off-mic relationship on mic, chaps. Okay.
What's happening this week, Henry?
I've got three things which are
say,
happening.
That's a thick pile of paper you've got there.
Yeah, it is indeed. We're going to begin with the inaugural Obama Foundation Summit, taking place in Chicago on the 31st of October. It is, according to this press release, an event that brings together hundreds of civic leaders from around the world to exchange ideas, explore creative solutions to common problems, experience civic art, technology and music, etc., etc. You get his drift. Now, this is a kind of event to preempt the establishment of the Obama Foundation, which is his kind of big presidential library / civic centre / digital interaction palace that he's going to open in Chicago.
It's going to be a thing.
Soon.
It's going to be a thing.
It's going to be a thing in the building. Kind of ahead of that, he's inviting some of his mates over, including Matteo Renzi, the former Prime Minister of Italy, and Prince Harry.
Good.
Who he's got a kind of...
Sort of unlikely bond.
I think so. A kind of unlikely and apparently sincere bond has been struck between them. Now, I want to hate Prince Harry.
I think he's a good bloke.
I lean towards republicanism generally. But I was scrolling through the Kensington Palace Twitter feed earlier, and actually, he's okay, isn't he?
He's a good egg.
If you are going to be a scion of an unelected ruling class, then you may as well just, you know, get involved in the charity, and he's doing so. And particularly, I think, when our elected leaders in this country and in so many other countries around the world are acquitting themselves so poorly.
Yeah, we're scraping the barrel, aren't we,
elected officials, to criticise.
Plus, he has a big old bushy red beard, just like you.
There's that too. I'm not sure if that influences my views on him, but, you know.
A kindred spirit.
Potentially. Also on the 31st. Actually, all of the things that I'm going to talk about are happening on the 31st of October to this week. Love Film, remember that?
I do remember it. That was good, wasn't it? Love Film. It became Netflix, didn't it? It was bought by Netflix.
It was bought by Amazon, actually.
Oh.
But basically, their by-post DVD rental service is going to end. Now, you'll remember that Love Film...
Surely that's already ended.
It's still going on, apparently. It kind of preempted the streaming revolution. I say preempted. It was kind of the Betamax to the streaming revolution's VHS,
yes.
Wasn't it? The mini-disc to its MP3. It was a kind of attempt to fulfil the same function in society, which missed... Frankly,
It was quite good, wasn't it?
It was quite good, kind of going to Blockbuster. You sent off a film, so they sent it to you, and I think you returned it in the same packaging, didn't they? But some subscribers apparently are up in arms about this, because apparently a wider selection of films are available
on DVD.
Exactly, by the physical subscription. And this got me thinking about the fact that it is awfully convenient to have all of this media on demand, be it music with Spotify or films with the numerous streaming services which are now available. But sometimes it does feel that even when you're trying to go wildly off-piste, it's kind of weirdly curated as an experience.
Do you know what I find
difficult? The serendipity to being in the record store.
It's up to you. You can, okay, you spend, name any track in the world. You tend to come back to staples.
Definitely.
That's what I do with my musical choices. And that strange thing of browsing CDs on someone's shelves, and you would be like, what is this?
Yeah, exactly.
And the true discovery, you're guided towards discoveries you may like. And actually, I'm finding it's weirdly... I think it's weirdly narrowing my focus.
It is. It's very much the algorithm has good taste, and that's its main downfall, is that it has good taste. And it kind of knows what you should like. If you like Neil Young, you'll like Bob Dylan. Everyone knows this. But if you kind of like, if you like Bob Dylan, maybe you shouldn't like Erasure's first three singles. And they're absolutely amazing. And you're on your shelves at home, you would have had those three CDs all lined up next to each other. And that's, as you're right, Henry. That's the thing. You can't actually engineer the serendipity that the human mind and the human eye sees on a shelf.
And finally, also on the 31st of October, the Reba Sterling Prize, the most prestigious prize in UK architecture, is being presented in London. There are two buildings on the shortlist which particularly interest me as someone from Swansea, which is a kind of dilapidated seaside town. One of them, Hastings Pier.
Oh, yeah.
I've
strolled down Hastings Pier.
Have you? Yeah. Since it's been refurbished?
Since it's been refurbished, yeah.
Yeah, so basically it was a kind of rundown pier that finally the death knell was sounded when it was arsonated. Is that a word?
It's not, but we know what
it
you're
was set on fire.
Oh, wow.
And now...
Don't be Google image searching that at work.
I think, Rob, you're not a bit arsonated when you walk down Hastings Pier that time.
An architecture firm called DRMM have made it sexy.
Okay.
Was it good, Rob?
Yeah, it was very good.
The second building I should mention is the seaside building nominated for the Reba Sterling Prize, Chatham Historic Dockyard, one of the most important dockyards in the sail age, apparently, has been refurbished with a striking new visitor entrance, it says here.
So, had it been previously arsonated?
I don't think that there has been any arsonation in Chatham. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. We start the show with a band that will be familiar to Monocle 24 listeners as we play their tracks quite often. It's Little Dragon, formed in Sweden back in 1996.
Their latest album, Season High, was released earlier this year, back in April, in fact. And here, with Rob and I in the studio, are Yukimi and Eric from Little Dragon. Guys, welcome to the programme. Great
Thank
to have you with
you.
Me.
Thank you.
How's the tour going? You both look pretty well on it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, it's been good. This is like, I guess yesterday was like the fourth show.
Mm.
So we
in
are
Manchester.
Playing, yeah, Manchester, playing in London tonight and tomorrow.
I'm sort of look like I'm directing traffic. There's some sort of bug in the studio here. Sorry, everybody. That was kind of really off-putting. Ask your guests a question and then sort of wave your arms around, like swatting a moth or something.
Oh, there was a fly in here earlier.
I think it's because Yukimi, when you came in, you as a connoisseur of studios, both of you, you said, "Oh, this is pretty nice in here. There's something deluxe or something about this place."
Right.
One of the things, I think this is made of sort of goat hair. The tablecloth.
It's goat
and the walls.
Carpet fabric.
Oh,
I think that could attract a moth. I think that's maybe what's been flying around.
That's what it is.
None of this bit will end up in the finished programme. <of course>. So on tour, everyone wants to know about folklore, about tour folklore, and about what you do, about how you prepare. You guys are playing the Roundhouse this weekend and tonight. What happens? So you've come in here this morning, but what happens? How do you progress through the day? Do you have it on lockdown, this touring thing, and knowing what you're going to do and when you're going to do it? Or do you take every day as it comes?
Most of the time, there's a lot of tristesse.
Really, is there?
Yeah, it's a lot of
looking waiting. Out of rainy windows.
Yeah, a lot of... Yesterday we were in Manchester, we looked out at a parking lot and... You drift away. How can this be enhanced and more fun? And then, should I take drugs or shall I be... No.
Yeah.
No, I shouldn't.
You've got to know what time of day to take.
Yeah, exactly. So we try to stay sober.
Yeah.
Try to stay fit, you know, try to... Because the day is all about that 1.5 hour when you perform. And
get some daylight.
Get some vitamin D.
Yeah.
Do you want us to turn up the lights in here? Are you guys okay?
No, we feel at home, actually.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Yeah. There is a bit of Gothenburg gloom about
this. Yeah, exactly.
It's cozy.
Very good.
Yeah, it's cozy, right? And so how do you do it? So I always think of this when I think of bands going on stage. It's all right for us. We turn up. You're on stage at 9 o'clock. We turn up. We have a few beers, la, 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 and all the rest of it. You guys are sort of... You know, you guys are kind of like biting your nails in the green room.
Yeah.
When does it all kick off for you? Do you have to decompress afterwards? Like at the Roundhouse or something? You're in the middle of Camden, good old scruffy Camden. Do you get? Can you go out after that, or is it kind of back on the tour bus? Nighty night.
There's a bit of finger pointing going
She's
on.
She's the only one that can answer this one.
Yeah, this one is a dangerous question.
It varies.
Yeah.
It varies. Sometimes I guess you have to sort of let the night move on, and other times you have to shut it down.
Yeah, okay.
Are you listening
it's
to
all about
Rob?
Balance.
It's about balance.
It's about balance. No, but of course, it's like any job, you know. It's like, but our problem is that it is Friday and Saturday every day, but you have to make it. Like once a week, you really have to release all that party.
Pent up.
Yeah.
Emotion.
Exactly.
Tired and emotional.
How's that changed? Because it's funny, even in our introduction, talking back to founding, you know, 1996, it seems extraordinary. I can't believe it's actually that amount of time.
No, that's crazy. But
do you reckon have you refined the art of coping with it over, what, a couple of decades? I mean, it's amazing, isn't it?
Well, we met actually in 96. We didn't really quite start the band, but for example, me and Eric, we met, I was 14. Yeah. They were like 16 or something. Yeah.
Oh, he was the older bad influence.
Exactly. We kind of got drawn to each other and you know, we're just hanging out, listening to music and stuff like that. But it wasn't until, you know, later on that we sort of started writing and being a band. But I mean, we've known each other for so long. It's insane. I don't know.
Yeah, you learn how to cope with our different skills and
personalities
and handicaps or whatever. No, errors.
I like that. Normally people sort of say, oh, you know, it's become one of those things where we just finish each other's sentences. You're like, I put up with a lot of errors.
Exactly.
Let's just be plain about this.
They just keep on adding more and more errors for every day.
I guess, yeah, but it is, you know, it's about accepting, okay, and this is also something maybe you can learn at like a couples therapy or something, you know, but it's like, it's definitely about accepting who the other people are, you know, not trying to change them or, you know.
Yeah.
All the errors, basically.
The on-tour thing is we think of people working and living closely and living kind of out of each other's pockets in every way. What about when you're recording? You kind of, that's a similar sort of thing as well, right? I mean, I understand you guys have been using the same studio since your debut LP.
Yeah.
Is that part and parcel of it, kind of having a bit of grounding in there so that you kind of come in and out of work, as it were, in and out of your office? But is the importance of having the same studio kind of a grounding thing?
I think in the set, we were just talking yesterday about, like, someone was saying, yeah, you know, the Beatles, they recorded their first album in 8 hours in Sun Studio. Well, they obviously didn't write the songs in 8 hours. No. I mean, that would have been super impressive, actually.
Well, we were like, we could have done that faster.
Yeah.
But I think, like, just for us, we kind of came up in that time where everyone was having their own home studios, you know. You just needed a computer and a microphone, basically. Didn't need that much, maybe a keyboard. That was it. And then, you know, everyone was making music in their room, or, you know, you didn't necessarily need to have a fancy studio with a huge mixing table to be writing a record anymore. People were just putting out their music on the internet, and there it was. And it was another album in the sea of albums.
Another album.
Our studio is more of a place where we can just store things, and then we keep our own little PC-oriented studio, home studio, in there. The studio is more of an oasis within our grey, boring city of Gothenburg, where we can be spaced out and really, I mean, search within and explore the world of music. So in that way, it's very good to have that studio.
I love the idea of that, that it's your kind of bolt hole. Yeah. Do you listen to a lot of music in there? Do you put records on? Do you turn up sometimes to the studio and just put records on and listen to stuff together? Or do you have to kind of keep church and state apart? You know, you don't want to contaminate your music and listen to lots of other music when you're recording. How does that work?
Not as much. I mean, I feel like we don't listen to as much music as we probably could be doing. I think we get so zoned into listening to our own demos and sketches that, you know, like when I think about when we've been asked in the past, like, what music were you influenced by to write this or that or whatever, I just think about, like, what was I listening to? I was just listening to demos, like, over and over and over again, and thinking about, that's probably what I think all of us were listening to the most, you know, the most intensely, is our own music. But then, of course, the influences are there from all over the place, so, you know, going way back.
But also it sounds, you can't, in interviews, it's difficult to say that, isn't it? You kind of go, what have you been listening to? Yeah. Well, a lot of myself, actually.
Yeah,
it sounds
exactly.
Like self-regarding. Isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
yeah. It's very self-centered.
But absolutely. You presumably have to be very self-centered to get yeah. this stuff. Once you've started one of these ideas, you've got to presumably, I don't know what it feels like, you've got to sort of scrabble after that idea to hold on to it, right? Because
right.
it can pass out, go in one ear, on, in one ear and out the other quite quickly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Like trying to catch a butterfly or a moth.
Yeah.
In a well-decorated
it's
studio.
Exactly how it is. Actually.
Yeah.
And what about working with other people? So on the fifth, on Season High, you work with James and Patrick, is that right, the producers?
Yeah.
Well, is that a question of like finding people who kind of get, who are sort of tuned into your the way you work, or is it about almost deliberately trying to find people who maybe have a different approach and mixing
right.
that in? Or what was that process like?
Well, I think to be honest, it was something that we felt a little bit pressured, you know, by people were like, you should use a producer, you should, you know, when are you guys, this is the step to have a producer. And I think for us, we were kind of like, well, we're all producers, you know, we've been producing our own albums year after year. Like, why would we need a producer? That just feels strange. But then I think we got to a point where we were kind of like, okay, are we just being hard-headed here? Like, have to do everything myself, you know, don't want to have anybody's help. I think we kind of got to the point where we were like, let's be open and try something new. And if it doesn't work, you know, we don't have to keep it, you know. So, and then we got suggested, there were all kinds of different producers that came up. James Ford was one of them, and we actually met him in Australia. So it made sense to work with him because we really liked him and actually like, you know, the music that he's made and stuff. So we had a chat with him, and just all sort of happened very like naturally with him. And
there's a bit of serendipity to that, you know, you meet people, it just sort of clicks. You don't have
yeah.
to kind of overthink it, I suppose.
No. Exactly. And we were at this point with the album where it was almost done. You know, we'd been working on it so much, but then you know, I guess part of the problem is sometimes being real close and being four producers is that, you know, you just sort of sometimes disagree over and over. And when that fresh pair of ears come in and kind of can say like, you know, try this, try that, and everyone's like silent, like okay, it makes it very
well,
easy.
It clearly worked, right?
yeah.
That's a tough one though, when you've almost finished a record and then someone comes in with their red pen, their red, or not necessarily, but you know, they've got an edit on it. That's, is that tough to, you've got to be quite big, haven't you? You've got to be quite big people to take that on the chin, have you?
But James was very smooth, actually. I think
what they call him.
Yeah,
well, maybe
James.
He comes with a saxophone sound.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. He really, I mean, he was very humble, you know, so he kind of just gave us back. You can be very confident about a song, but then a year later, mixing it in and out and trying, your confidence is like decreasing. So he just like, oh, it's a great track, you know, just pump up and crank it. And pretty much that's what he did. Kind of reaffirming the songs to us.
Well, you said, I mean, it's such a lovely record. Everyone, I mean, when you say you're going to interview Little Dragon, everyone's like, oh, I love Little Dragon. Everyone, nice. And it's one of those things, it's, you know, it blushes aside, but it is, it's fine. It's such a nice thing. Everyone loves their albums. Everyone wants to see you guys live.
Oh.
And everyone, it sort of feels like a friendly vibe. And I wanted to ask you about something. People have talked a lot about the Scandinavian sense of melody and why is singing in English so perfectly rendered, and as I say, the melody and all the rest of it. That's been discussed before, but the Gothenburg thing, you sort of joked about your dark city and all the rest of it, Gothenburg.
Right.
But your songs, your records are so sunny and playful and bright and impish. What is that? Is that a reaction against it? Because all these records are cut in Gothenburg, right?
Yeah.
Where does that come? Do you know where that comes from, or is that the $64 million question?
Yeah.
I haven't got it on me, by the way.
It's a bit of escapism, I think, to maybe get out of. I mean, Gothenburg is really no different from, for example, Manchester. It's just smaller. It's a working class city. But it's a great chilled out place. We have a lot of time. But the weather isn't that great, so you try to escape the sun.
You make your own sun.
You know. Yeah,
I was reminded of like those wonderful guitar bands from Glasgow in the early 80s and all the way up to sort of teenage fan clubs, that making things that sounds Californian.
Yeah.
They're
right.
In goddamn Glasgow. You know what I mean? And there is something escapism about it.
Yeah.
It's looking through those rain-lashed windows.
Yeah,
again, Eric.
Yeah.
The poetic image has come full circle.
I mean, when we make music, we try to make a sort of a healthy therapeutic potion to heal ourselves, you know, like it's mainly for ourselves we write our music, just to close our eyes and feel so good, you know.
I love it. Here, yeah. Here, right?
Yeah. That's perfect.
That is the way to finish an interview, isn't it?
Right there.
We'll cut off what I've been saying. It'll stop there. Yeah. I love you both so much. I love the band. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you so much. The record is Season High.
Little Dragon are on tour. And you've got a bit of a Northern European tour thing going on, haven't you? In the depths of winter, you're going to Amsterdam, Zurich.
Playing, yeah, exactly. First, we stay around up here.
Up here.
And then we go down. we finish in Milan, Milano, or whatever it's called in the English language. But
I think listeners just probably Google Translate. Yeah. What's he talking about? What's this place? How do I get there? Yeah. Thank you both very much for coming.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys.
Time for some music now. This is from Little Dragon's latest album called Season High, and this is Strobe Light.
And that was Strobe Light from Season High, from Little Dragon. A delight, Rob, to chat with the guys and to hear some of their beautiful music.
Aren't they one of those bands that everyone loves? Everyone wants to meet them. Everyone wants to high-five them. Everyone wants to give them a hug.
We loved them before they came in. We love them even more now.
Love them even more now, if it's possible.
'97, Rob. Yep. When I say that year to you, what does that conjure straight away for you?
Queuing up for Be Here Now and the horrible disappointment.
That's good.
A bit like New Labour, the queuing up for years for it to come along and then being horribly disappointed by it, possibly.
Well, funny you should say that, Rob. New Labour coming to power, Britpop.
Tick.
Spice Girls. There was an optimism around. Was it soon dashed?
Exactly. Could any of that bring an effective change? Well, the author Richard Power Said has his doubts too. He spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco about his book 1997, The Future That Never Happened.
Richard, thank you so much for coming here, Monocle 24. It's a very interesting book. And of course, The Future That Never Happened, 1997. Tell us, why did you choose? What's the relevance of that year in particular?
There's an almost ridiculous number of extraordinary things that happened in 1997 in Britain. Often people will say, like, that's a kind of random thing to do. Is it because it's the 20th anniversary? And when you say, well, it was when New Labour came to power. It's when Princess Diana died and the monarchy was rocked. It's when the Stephen Lawrence campaign went from being something that very few people in Britain knew about. It was something that only most of Britain's black community were aware of, turned into the great cause celebre of race relations, as it used to be called. It's the year that the Spice Girls turned into the biggest band in the world. It's the year that Britpop went from being something cool and quite popular to being the kind of the ultra orthodoxy of pop music in this country. It's the year that the YBAs, the young British artists, people like Tracy Emin and Damien Hirst, went from being very minor jokes in the tabloids to being proper A-list celebrities. It's a moment of extraordinary change in British history.
And so let's talk about some of the things you just mentioned, especially politics. I think New Labour was such a massive change after much more than a decade of Conservative government. But apparently, you know, especially after reading the book, you know, it was maybe a good thing that year, but maybe New Labour didn't use the power it's had in a nice way, because in some ways you mentioned that what happened there in fact culminated into Brexit. Can you explain a little bit more?
New Labour offered a moment of extraordinary hope. After 18 years of deregulation and privatization and austerity under the Conservatives, which, you know, there were different arguments about how necessary it was, but what was absolutely certain was that it had created an exceptionally unequal society, and a society where equality of opportunity had tanked. In these two key measures of what makes a good society, Britain was far, far behind other developed countries. And there was no hope that New Labour was going to do what we think Jeremy Corbyn's going to do, which is build socialism and a much more equal society. But there was the hope that it would be a fairer society.
And they had the power to do it.
Yeah, you know, finally Labour was back in power. And that hope of a more tolerant, a more cosmopolitan society, a fairer one, and one that seemed modern in this kind of intangible way, that was really important for a lot of people. And it didn't happen. It really didn't happen. Maybe you could say that the neoliberal tide was slowed, but you definitely couldn't say that it was stopped. And New Labour actually didn't try to stop it. Britain continued to become a more unequal country. It's just that the rate at which it became unequal slowed.
And it's interesting in other aspects, especially cultural aspects. For example, you mentioned the Spice Girls and Girl mm-hmm. Power. You said, you know, at the beginning it was like a new way of feminism, but you said that actually this was actually not so good for the movement in general. What do you think?
Well, I suppose it's a very kind of ambiguous thing, isn't it? Because at the time and since, many feminists have very, very reasonably criticised the Spice Girls. They've said that this kind of extremely sexualised form of self-expression, you know, produces just the idea that women are objects. And girl power was in many ways just a gimmick, a shtick through which marketing men could sell things to little girls and manipulate them into being better consumers, which is really the very antithesis of women becoming more autonomous and more independent and resisting the kinds of ways in which our society tries to control them. But then again, actually, if you ask many young feminists today, they'll say, you know what, the Spice Girls were an extremely imperfect introduction to feminism, but they were actually the first time that lots of people of my generation, men and women, heard this idea, like women can be independent, women can stick up for each other, women don't have to care what men think. There was something almost bizarre and certainly exceptional and extraordinary and impressive about the fact that a pop band were being marketed with this explicitly ideological idea. You know, they used the word feminist, which was about as uncool as it could possibly be.
What about the presence of Britain at the world stage, or even the image of Britain to other countries? If you compare 2017, do you see Britain a diminished country in that sense?
I think that's how a lot of people perceive Britain, and that's partly because it seems much more inward-facing now. Tony Blair literally spoke about rebranding Britain, which is, you know, a pretty extraordinary kind of thing to say. You're going to take a society of tens of millions of people, which has existed for hundreds of years, and you're going to rebrand it. But he certainly wanted Britain to be more outward-facing, to understand itself as European. Robin Cook, who was the Foreign Secretary in 1997, said he was going to create an ethical foreign policy. It was going to be internationalist, some people said. And now the UK is anything but any of those things. We are so riven with obvious tensions.
We were talking before we went on air. I mean, I was joking that people say, oh, you should write another book, I don't know, 2016 because of Brexit. But was there a year as relevant as 97 so far?
I'd probably be doing it myself. People would be like, oh, I'll wait for the next one if there's a more important year. Of course, no year in itself is the most important year. Everything relies upon the context, right? You could write a book which says that everything changed with the oil crisis of the early 1970s. That was, you know, maybe the kind of seminal moment through which you can track everything from Brexit to ISIS. But 97 was so crucial for Britain. Perhaps it was specifically because New Labour came to power. A lot of these other questions, you know, how was Britain going to respond to the death of Princess Diana? How was it going to respond to the Stephen Lawrence campaign and this question of why had the police failed to properly investigate the racist murder of a black teenager? They absolutely rested upon the question of who was going to be in government. And because New Labour were in government, Tony Blair responded to the death of Princess Diana in this very self-consciously modern way, self-consciously kind of symbolically egalitarian. He was going to make the monarchy modern. And I think then that acted as a kind of fulcrum for all of these other cultural events. You know, it seemed to make sense that the Spice Girls, that were this kind of egalitarian pop band in some weird way, because we had this kind of similarly bright and optimistic government. Once one thing is there, it creates the momentum, it creates the sense that things are changing. And people said that at the time. You know, if you read the comment pages of the newspapers, everybody was really excited about cool Britannia.
Was there any positive legacy from this year that is applied today?
New Labour had some significant achievements in terms of massively expanding the spending on schools, massively expanding the spending on hospitals, and on this important scheme that Gordon Brown had called Sure Start. But so much of that was completely kind of destroyed by the tide of crisis and austerity and recession after 2007. And even those achievements that they had were, you know, relatively unambitious, actually. And also, we can say that the crisis was, to a significant extent, it was their fault, because after Margaret Thatcher had deregulated the banks, Gordon Brown had continued to do so. And he'd done so because he wanted to use the tax receipts from the financial services to pay for his welfare spending. Well, guess what? You know, all of the benefits of that welfare spending were thrown away by the effect of the recession.
That was Richard Power Said speaking to Fernando. And 1997, The Future That Never Happened, is out now, published by Zed Books. And you're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. To mark their first 20 issues throughout 7 years, Quarterly Arts and Literature magazine The White Review has decided to launch a book featuring their best fiction, essays, interviews and poetry.
Co-founder and editor of The White Review, Ben Eastham, is here to tell us about The White Review Anthology. Welcome to The Monocle Weekly, Ben. Good to have you back at Midori House.
To be here again. It's been a while.
So it's an anthology, as Rob mentioned, fiction, essays, interviews, poetry. Tell us, I don't know, the origin stories of this beautiful book. I have a copy. I'm just browsing through it right now. Was it always on your mind to bring The White Review contents into a sort of more bookish form?
It had been something we'd been thinking about for a long time, certainly, and it seemed appropriate. It marks the 20th print issue of the magazine and the 7th anniversary of its foundation. The 20 print issues were an opportunity for us both to go back through everything we'd printed and to bring everything together in this anthology, and also to reconsider the magazine. So we're rebranding, we're changing the way the website operates. We brought in a new editorial team and are just shifting some of the emphases. So it felt really like a roundup of that first era of the magazine, I suppose, from when we started to the point we're at now. An opportunity as well for us to really promote some of the great stuff we've had and illustrate, I suppose, some of the writers that might not have been household names when they were initially published in the magazine, who have since gone on to greater success.
And does doing a book kind of make you, you said, sort of slightly reconsider how you do the magazine, actually? Something is a different size, it's a different pagination, you've got a different set of strictures, but also a different set of opportunities with the book. Is that one of the things that's a catalyst for how the new version of the magazine might look?
Certainly, yeah, it's something we're considering. I think we've always occupied this slightly awkward space between a conventional magazine and a journal or a book. And it's something that we wanted to develop in the new magazine, which is being redesigned. The book aspects of the magazine have always been to its advantage, but also bring certain difficulties. Doing the anthology was in part a way to present something that's unapologetically a book as we move towards a new format of the magazine, which will be a little bit taller, a little bit brighter, and a little bit refreshed, I guess. I mean, the publishing industry has changed as well in the 7 years since we started the magazine, and certainly the independent publishing industry. So we wanted to stay fresh, to not start again, but to build upon what we've achieved thus far. And this felt like a good time to do it.
One of those things, talking about the publishing industry, it's changing since you guys launched The White Review. It's due to people like yourselves. And also we found with Monocle, it's been 10 years since we did Monocle. When you start to look like the people that have copied you, you have to move things on a bit, right? So it's a kind of mark of respect to you guys as well, that you need to kind of keep ahead of the people that like your magazine so much, they're snipping at your heels creatively.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's flattering. That imitation is flattering, but it's certainly something we've seen. And I think the entire atmosphere around independent publishing has shifted in these 7 and 10 years. What initially seemed like a stupid project, and in certain ways probably was born out of naivety.
That was the elevator pitch. Well, it's a stupid project. Give me your money.
Well, there didn't seem to be a market for it, and certainly the kind of atmosphere. One of the reasons we started the magazine, in fact, was because there was such a negative atmosphere around independent publishing at that time. And we felt that there were opportunities actually for small and more nimble publishers. In the intervening 7 years, there's really been an explosion in independent publishing. The number of independent magazine fairs, kind of visibility of those print magazines has really increased dramatically. And consequently, there's a lot more competition. So it did feel important to reconsider and to take stock of where we are now, and also to take stock of what we can do and what the future holds, and be aware that in those 7 years, things have changed and that maybe we can begin to be ahead of the curve again rather than behind it.
Now, Ben, you sort of go back to the origin stories and that mix of sort of serendipity, maybe drunkenness, that kicks the whole process off in your introduction at the start of the anthology. But to pick up on that idea of these changes, I mean, is it, I don't want to ask a glib question, has it been, I don't know, has it been incredibly difficult? Has it been easy to get where you are? Or have you always sort of found that you've kind of managed to make the right decisions? I mean, a lot of people you talk to, whether it's an independent magazine or independent publishing house, they talk about having a lot of luck. I mean, does that play its role too?
Certainly luck is part of it. I think we were fortunate in the sense that we started at a time when there were relatively few competitors. There wasn't anyone doing much the same. And actually, one of the reasons we started it was precisely because of that. We were both living in London, myself and Jack, who founded the magazine, and felt that there was an opportunity for a small publisher to publish writing that was fantastic, that wasn't finding an audience elsewhere. So it did feel like there was content there and there were writers around who weren't finding a space. And we were able to take advantage of that really by virtue of there not being many other people doing it. So in that sense, we were lucky. In addition to luck, I would also say that there's a tremendously supportive community around initiatives like The White Review. We've been very fortunate in that there are a lot of people who want things like that to succeed. I think everyone recognised that there weren't enough independent initiatives, not only in publishing, but also in the arts. And so when one pops up, there are a lot of people at various stages of their careers and with various levels of influence and reputation who are very willing to help it. And that has been an enormous support, that when we first started and we would approach writers and artists who we admired, but were enormously successful and busy, they would take time out of their schedule to help us, because I think they recognised that if the arts and publishing ecosystem is to continue to work, you need those small initiatives. You need those places that provide a platform to emerging artists and writers. So a large part of it, and a large part of the reason for the success of The White Review, such as it is, has been that support. So that has been enormously helpful, and I don't think we could have survived without that.
How well do you know your readers? When you're a smaller publication, you do a lot of events, you know, which support the art side of what you do, as well as the writing and all these. You throw a good party, and I'm sure one of the excuses of launching a book is to have a lash up. But it's quite important to have a bit more of a one-on-one, or at least a kind of group relationship with your readers, right?
Absolutely.
How do you guys administer to that?
Well, I think that's enormously important, and it's one thing that we were very conscious of when we started, that as aspiring writers and editors ourselves, and having, you know, a group of people around us who were trying to do something similar, it was very difficult to meet editors. It was actually very difficult to know where to place your work or how to, you know, meet other writers even. We started the magazine, it was very important to us that we did events, partly just to sell issues because they're a good opportunity, partly because it's fun, but also because it was a great way of meeting not only readers but also contributors. We've met so many people through the events we've done both in London and around the country and in Europe, who have gone on to work for the magazine or have given us something. It also gave us a great feedback on what we were doing.
It's a nice kind of accident. It's a kind of, the focus group is one thing, but doing it over a few drinks and introducing other people, that's a nice way of doing that awful thing.
It was a nice way, yeah.
Feedback.
But I think it also feeds into the idea that any institution of that size, any small institution, is much larger in the number of people who are involved in it than is represented on the masthead. It's everyone who comes to the events. It's everyone who you talk to. It's all the people who introduce you to other people. And through doing that, and over the course of the 7 years, we've been able to build up a network of people who can recommend people to us. And we're always looking to develop that. And doing events was the easiest way for us to do that, at the same time as also making a little bit of extra money as well, which is quite useful.
Ben, it strikes me as interesting. A lot of the things you say about being fleet of foot and being innovative are often things that are chucked around by very committed digital advocates in this space who say, oh, well, of course, you know, the democratizing power of the internet means that everyone can be a publisher, everyone can be an editor, there's fewer barriers to entry and so on. But does your experience with The Right Review and now with this new piece tell you that actually a traditional approach and, you know, traditional medium even, is far from being the kind of enemy of innovation that it's sometimes painted at? And actually the most innovative innovators are using proper, what I would consider to be proper formats and mediums,
proper materials,
to do their work.
Well, absolutely. And I think, you know, when we talked before, maybe 5 years ago and in the years prior to that, there was very much the discussion around publishing was that digital was taking over, it was going to destroy print publishing, that digital was the future, and actually that the two forms were completely incompatible, the two media were incompatible, and that actually everything would go into digital. I think what our experience has demonstrated, and I think this is something that industry-wide people have realised or are beginning to realise, is that the two forms can be entirely complementary. A large part of the reason that we've been able to do this is because, you know, of the internet. I mean, we've had a website on which we publish different material, but also excerpts from the print magazine. We also have social media, and these are incredibly great ways of reaching audiences that we would never otherwise have been able to reach. We wouldn't be able to sell books to people, you know, who we're not reaching directly otherwise. We've been able to sell books through the website. We've been able to use the material on the website as a way of building up an audience who then invest in it. And those two media have become complementary. And actually what we've learned is that they're not necessarily oppositional. You don't either have to be a successful digital operation or a successful print operation, but you can work across the two and use the two to complement each other and develop an idea of a publisher which is broader than simply producing a print magazine or simply, you know, working with a website or simply doing blogs or social media or events, that actually it's much more possible now than it was 7-10 years ago to do all of those things together. And websites and social media are a way of stitching those different parts together at relatively low cost, and you can be quick and you can get out to people that we would never otherwise have been able to reach.
Also, the White Review came along 7 years ago at a time when people were scrabbling about, not knowing whether to, as your last answer alluded to, not knowing whether to launch an iPad edition of their magazine, how they would monetize that, whether advertisers wanted to sit on a digital page rather than a printed page, all this kind of stuff. I forget the name, Mr. O'Meara.
Ray O'Mara,
your designer, and you write nicely in the introduction about, you know, messing around with some typefaces and some fonts that he'd drawn up, all the rest of it. I suppose there was something about the launch of The White Review as well, that which was not to be ashamed of making something nice, right? When so many people kind of going, how do we make it look like a website, although it's on paper? You've embraced it, haven't you?
Well, absolutely. I think it builds into the same idea that actually whatever medium you're working in, you should exploit it to its best advantage. And that applies as much to digital as to print. But if you're going to produce something in print, and I think this is particularly important now, and the decision we made when we started out was that we would make an object which was collectible and beautiful and, you know, really thoroughly designed. You know, as you were saying, Ray designed typefaces for it. Our design at that time was quite unusual. It was very well produced because we felt that if we were going to go to the trouble of producing something in print, we had to take advantage of all the possibilities offered by print. It made it a little bit more expensive. I think the idea that you can really produce very cheap printed materials now that are ephemeral is slightly dying away because you can do that with a website, you know, very cheaply, very easily, and reach people much more quickly. But if you can produce an object which persists, which people actually want to hold and keep on their bookshelf, I think that takes printed materials into a slightly different realm. And also, I was working in, you know, I worked in art publishing as well, and I was producing books with galleries and art institutions, and I could see the demand for beautifully produced printed materials. And that's another thing that I think we've all seen develop over the past few years, is that actually people are willing to invest in beautifully produced books, but there's no point in producing something that doesn't have that quality, that isn't tactile, that isn't very well put together.
Well, on that point, Ben, can you tell us a bit about your artwork choices? Because there's some delightful little sort of line drawings inside from Camille. Tell us about those, because presumably, you know, that's a good old robust discussion about what graces the anthology cover.
Absolutely, and that's something Jacques and I, as the founding editors, and Ray as the designer, have always talked about. We were very keen as well to that those two sides of the operation would always be in discussion. So whatever Ray was selecting as the artworks to go in the magazine would very much respond to our editorial decisions in terms of what we were commissioning. And we really wanted to build that kind of those links around and to produce something that was coherent. Camille is an artist we've known for a long time and was interviewed in, I think, our 10th issue, and she did a series of her Ikebana flower arrangements that we published in our 5th issue. She has a show now at Palais de Tokyo. In the same way that the texts inside are, you know, our favourite historical material, working again with Camille was an opportunity to revisit one of our most satisfying creative collaborations, I think, and to work with someone who's very much participated in the development of the magazine.
It's such beautiful stuff. You talk about it so well as well, Ben.
As well you might.
It is the White Review anthology celebrating 7 years of the White Review. We're looking forward to the evolution as well of your fine magazine. For the time being, Ben Easton, thank you very much. And that was edition 434 of the Monocle Weekly. Tom, I'd have said that was a modern classic in the making.
It was such fun.
I had such a good time.
We always say light and shade and all this kind, all the rest.
Yeah.
But we had music, we had literary inspiration, all sorts.
Indeed.
It was great.
It's good stuff. I love it when people come into the studio and they bring their A game to it and you somehow manage to gird your loins, pull your socks up, wash your face and get into that studio and meet them somewhere on the
exactly.
level.
Exactly. I find that a rising tide raises all boats, Rob.
Oh, I love that.
And so when you have inspirational people like our friends from Little Dragon,
yeah.
it just, well, what we hope it brings out the best in us.
It's always high tide on the Monocle Weekly. There is no mud as far as the eye can see. There are no boats on their sides.
Absolutely not.
No? No sort of sad-looking lobster, smelly lobster pots.
Yeah, lobster cages, whatever they
okay.
are.
Okay. Shall we thank our pals behind the glass?
Let's do it, Rob.
Today's show is produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and researched by Katie Watkins, and our studio managers were Cassie Galpin.
And George McDonough.
And the Monocle Weekly will be back same time, same place, possibly same personnel, who knows. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bounds.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.